Carnell Lester Jackson versus Commonwealth. Good morning. Mr. Novy, would you like to reserve any rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes unless you'll take more of my time. And I'd like to ask permission to have more.
We can't promise anything.
Okay. 2 minutes.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Novy, and I represent the appellant Carnell Jackson in this matter, which was ultimately a conviction for murder and robbery and abduction and received essentially a life sentence, 50 years. The issue in the case was this. The single issue was, in the assignment of error, was the court error in refusing to strike juror number 15, who essentially acknowledged that she was impaired in performing her duties as a juror when she said that she was preoccupied with school, that she would have a difficult time giving both sides a fair trial. In fact, her statement, the Commonwealth asked anybody have any experience, and she brings it up first and says she actually has a class, she has a project due, so, and I quote, she's a bit preoccupied. Commonwealth asked two questions, and it's kind of unclear which one she answers. I understand that, Commonwealth says, in voir dire, but that aside, would that affect your ability to sit as a juror, a fair juror today, and just listen? She says yes at the end of both these questions. Then he says, could you still do that? Then she says yes. Mr. Jackson comes back and says, would it be difficult to sit here all 2 days? We know it's going to take more than 2 days. And another maybe inartful two-question, but at the end, would you have any problem giving both sides a fair trial? And her answer was, I think I'd be preoccupied, worried about missing school. So Mr. Jackson clarified, so the answer to your question is it will be difficult. She says yes. So
was there any point where she said she couldn't be a fair and impartial juror?
She never said that. But she acknowledged that it would be difficult for her to sit there and it depends on what her answer.
Most jurors, from my experience on the circuit court bench, most jurors, if they were honest, would say that it's a big inconvenience, but nevertheless they'll still do their duty.
I agree. And if there was follow-up questions by the court or by the Commonwealth as to her answers, then I think we wouldn't be here. We may not be here today. The problem is we don't have that follow-up. She ends it by saying, so is it fair to say that if you're chosen to sit here, will you have any problem giving both sides, the Commonwealth and my client, a fair trial and not to rush, etc.? And she says, I think I'd be preoccupied, worried about missing school. So we got follow-up again. So the answer to
your bottom line is the appellant's Sixth Amendment right to a jury.
A Sixth Amendment right to 12 members of a jury.
Who will give their undivided attention to the case.
Yes, sir. Undivided attention. And I supplemented late in the game to you all. I hope you received it. It goes without saying. But the Sixth Amendment, the U.S. Constitution says that a jury means 12 people. Nothing more, nothing less. Not 11 people that are going to pay attention and one that's going to sit back there because she has to.
Mr. Novy, aren't a lot of people, though, preoccupied, if they're honest, with a lot of things when they're sitting on a jury? They're worried about their family at home. They're worried about whether their job's being done or, in this case, their project at school.
Certainly. Many of them are. But
Wouldn't the Calhoun case from the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said, talking about the juror, her obvious reluctance to serve as a juror was not a basis for disqualification. Why wouldn't that essentially not, I mean, why wouldn't that control this case?
Well, because I would argue that what protective juror number 15 said is, in response, I guess it's all fact specific and the question specific. People are preoccupied, people are worried. But people don't want to serve, people have other things. But when this person says, when she follows up with the answer is, when the question is, would it be difficult? Will you have any problem giving both sides a fair trial? And her answer, I take it, I argue, is yes. I'm going to have a problem doing it. It's different than we know they're going to go, when we know in the beginning that this person has got a project, her class, she's telling us, I'm not going to be able to do this job, essentially. I'm going to have a difficult time doing it. then why wouldn't a judge say, let's pick somebody else that's not going to tell us that up front?
Well, you might very well be right, but that doesn't mean it's error not to.
Well, the standard review is for manifest error, but the cases that I cited, and as I quote said in my brief, most of these, all the cases I found deal with impartiality issues. That's traditionally when they come to the court.
And you're not suggesting there's anything to suggest this juror had a previously formed opinion or
no,
was,
sir.
Or
no
was
impartiality
prejudice
issue.
Or any, okay.
The issue, but the cases are very instructive and the language is very instructive. In one I quoted, Green versus Commonwealth, I think the language of those cases, when Supreme Court in Green says that when they talk about the standard of review, but they say the court's in a position to determine whether prospective jurors' responses during voir dire indicate that the juror will be prevented from, and I quote, or impaired in performing duties of a juror as required by the court's instructions and the jury's oath. So if she's saying, I'm going to be impaired in my job, and her job, as we know, is to listen to all the evidence, listen to the judge's instructions, participate in deliberation. And if a person is saying, I'm going to be preoccupied, I can't do it, I would suggest that...
Well, she never said, I can't do it.
Well, she said it would be difficult to do.
Well, in fact, the trial court ruled that while she would rather not be here, nothing suggests she would not pay attention. Didn't the trial court say that?
Oh, the court did say that. And my suggestion...
And what deference do we give to that? The trial court's in court. He's viewing the demeanor of the jurors.
Well, I guess it's the same deference that this court gave in Brown versus Jackson. In Brown versus Jackson, you may recall that case. This one was impartiality. It was a rape case, an abduction, and a potential juror.
She had been the victim of a
sexual assault. And when you look at her answers, I think I would be fair. I have no reason to believe my experience would influence me. I absolutely could presume the defendant to be innocent, to be an innocent man. And the trial court overruled Brown's motion to strike her, and the court reversed. Despite all of her assurances
isn't that a very different situation? That's a question of, she's got to put aside her own traumatic experience to try to be fair there. Here, somebody's worried about a project they've got due, but probably everybody in that courtroom, or most of them, are worried about something they've got to be doing in the next several days.
And I don't disagree that the issue is different, but the standard of review, I would suggest, and in fact it is the same, and I quote, again, I'll quote Brown, the case that from this court, her responses indicate a great deal of equivocation and created reasonable doubt about her fitness as a juror. Because all doubts about the fitness of jurors to serve must be resolved in favor of the accused, we hold the trial court erred in refusing to strike. So if you take that standard and say, when this person has told you in a case where, regardless of the case, or when a case where a man's life is on the line, and she says, I'm going to have a difficult time and being fair, being able to do my job as a juror, then why wouldn't the court strike that person for cause and get somebody that doesn't have that issue up front, that doesn't tell you that?
Can I ask you on that? I hear your argument completely on that and the comparison to Brown, but not that many people are going to have the reason, if we want to be able to fill our juries, of the person in Brown. But, I mean, you're sort of making an argument about how will this work. We get the 12 impartial people. If everybody were completely frank and said, well, I'm really worried about my child at home or my mother who's sick, or I'm worried about what I've got due at work, or I've got this test coming up at school, and I just couldn't pay attention very closely, I'm afraid, would we be able to fill our juries after a while?
Well, we would, because as I said in the beginning, if there was a follow-up question by the Commonwealth or the judge just said, based on Jackson's question to her, she ended by saying, And again, any problem, do you have any problem, will you have any problem to give both sides a fair trial? I think I would be preoccupied, worried about missing school. I mean, that's a question, answer. Follow-up, I think I'd be preoccupied, worried about missing school. So the answer to that would be, it would be difficult, yes. If the record showed that the judge said, or somebody else said, I know it'd be difficult, but if the judge told you to go, that you had a duty to participate, to listen, to deliberate in the back, are you telling us you could not do that? If she says, no, I couldn't do it, or yes, I would, I'll follow the instructions, then that's the way. I mean, I don't think we're here to decide policy, I guess. I mean, sure, everybody could say that, but that's when the judge takes over and says, look, I know you've got a place to be, would you be able to do this? That wasn't asked. So the record before this court is that this young lady says, it's going to be difficult. And if she says it's going to be difficult to give both sides a fair trial, then, and you read Green, that I would suggest that's the same as saying she's impaired in performing her duties because she's preoccupied. Again, if the statute was you get 11 jurors or you get 12 back, you have only 11 have to participate, then that's not, then we'll say, well, she could have gone back there and slept. Because what if she went back there, and we don't know, and there's no way to know, but what if she went back there and said, I didn't pay attention, I'm thinking about how I'm going to do my project at school, in school, you all just tell me what to do and I'll vote that way. Then that's not, that violates.
But you are a misconduct issue though, right? I mean, that's a totally separate issue.
Well, it would, but we'll never know that. But that would violate the Sixth Amendment. The U.S. Constitution says you get 12 jurors who will participate. It's the impartiality issue is one, but this is another issue that hadn't been decided. What if she went back there and there were 11 of them participated? And I guess let me back up. What if one juror said, I have no short-term memory. I'm going to listen, but I can tell you up front, I can't remember what anybody says after 5 minutes, but I'll do my best. Does that juror go back there? Is that a jury of 12 people? So maybe it's not a great example, but this person is forecast, and again, I'll close by saying to Judge Beals, if there was something on this record that said, where the judge asked, yes, I understand you got a lot to do. You got, everybody does. Would you follow the instructions? Would you participate in deliberation? And if she says yes, then this would not be an issue. So I'll save the rest of my time if I may.
Thank you. You have 2.5 minutes. Ms. Keenan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Keenan, and I represent the Commonwealth in this appeal. Trial court did not err in refusing to strike juror 15 for cause. Juror 15 was an impartial juror, and I don't think there's any serious debate about that here today. Her reluctance to serve on the jury for personal reasons was not a basis for her disqualification. The dialogue cited in the transcript does not show that juror 15 was unable to be impartial. It merely shows that she was reluctant to serve on the jury in the first place. And as Judge Beals noted, the Supreme Court has held that that is not a basis for disqualification. This court has also held in unreported cases, Carter and Meekins, that a reluctance to serve on a jury was not a basis for disqualifying an otherwise impartial juror. And to look at the transcript itself, at appendix page 31, I think the Commonwealth attorney does ask the question that the defendant says should be asked. It's admittedly a compound question, but he asks the juror, if you are required, could you still do this? That full question, the compound question, says, I appreciate that you're preoccupied, I understand that, but that aside, would that affect your ability to sit as a fair and impartial juror today and just listen? If you are required, could you still do that? She says yes. The defendant reads that yes as being a response to the first part of the compound question. I would read it as being a response to the latter part of that question. But more importantly, the trial judge, who was there to see and listen to the juror, to judge her demeanor while she answered these questions, the trial court held that she just would rather not be there, didn't hold that she wouldn't be able to pay attention, and this court should defer to the trial court's finding of fact with regard to this juror. This statement is also...
Help me, I'm sorry, Ms. Karen, help me with this.
Sure.
Where in the record does it say that she stated that she could give a fair trial and not rush or not be attentive?
Where does it say that the negative statement, that she would not be able to do that, or that she...
No, that she would be able to be attentive and devote her attention to the trial.
I think, Your Honor...
Something similar. But to me, when I'm reading, I've read it a number of times, doesn't answer the question.
That particular interaction with the Commonwealth Attorney or the...
On page, unless there's others, on page 47.
I think, Your Honor, looking at the voir dire as a whole, the earlier questions posed both by the court at the beginning and by the Commonwealth Attorney when he went through and said, could you follow the law?
I'm sorry, what page would that be?
On page 10:44 or 45 or 46, when she's talking about when all the jurors are saying they understand the presumption of innocence, the defendant's not required to testify, and then on page 20, the Commonwealth says, can each of you promise by raised hand to follow the law based on the evidence before you at the trial? If so, please raise your hand. All hands are raised. So I believe in that sentence there, saying that she could follow the law and the evidence. She agreed to do that. She's saying that she could give her attention to this trial. She could follow the law. She understands the law. She understands the presumption of innocence and the burdens of proof in this case. And importantly, the trial court believed that she had the capacity to be an impartial juror. And an impartial juror is what the Constitution requires.
When they got to specifically about difficult for her to sit for 2 days, her answer seemed to say that all she would say is, I think I'd be preoccupied, worried about school. Mm-hmm. And that so the answer to that would be difficult. It would be difficult. And she said yes. It's on page 47.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, whether it would be difficult for her as a personal matter to sit on the jury does not impact her impartiality. It does not disqualify her from sitting on the jury, and is not the proper subject of a basis to strike for cause.
Okay, thank you.
Is your argument that the main place that Mr. Novy's point is where she expressed her concern, and Mr. Novy's point, well, it wasn't ever rebutted, is your argument that the main point that it was rebutted is at the bottom of page 31?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would be the clearest place where she speaks specifically to this issue, but looking at the voir dire as a whole, her affirmative responses
answers
to all the other questions, and also, again, the trial court didn't read those responses as her saying she was unable to pay attention. The trial court read her responses as her saying she didn't want to be there. And that's a factual finding by the trial court. And I think that that kind of ends the discussion on that matter when the court finds that she would just prefer not to be there. And as the court stated, many jurors have other things that preoccupy them as well. But it's not a basis to strike her for cause. It doesn't render her impartial or able to fulfill her duties as a juror. If there are no other questions from the court, I'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the Petersburg Circuit Court.
Thank you.
Just Mr.
Novy, 2 minutes,
okay.
Or whatever, 2.5 minutes.
Okay. The fact that she listens and judge says everybody understands she's person presumed innocent, and she apparently by raising her hand or not raising her hand, she when I'm saying she cannot understand the rules, that she could not understand those rules and apply them, it's that she has said, I cannot give a fair trial because I'm preoccupied. What if the person said, and the Commonwealth said, the judge found, and I understand give great credence or great, anyway, the judge says, I think she don't want to be here. What if a person, and the judge, any reason you couldn't serve, ladies, the person says, I don't want to be here, I'm not going to listen to anything anybody says, I'm not going to deliberate, and the judge says, well, that's not a good reason, you're going to be on there. That is not 12 jurors. If that person is on there, that panel is not free from exception. Because that person will be struck for cause, or should be. Because you've got to have free from exception. If that person refuses to do it, whether they don't want to, for whatever reason, it's not the reason, it's the fact that the person cannot participate in the process. Either because they don't want to, or they got too much on their mind. The last thing I want to say is in Brown, we talk about the discretion we give the court. In Brown, the court, and I quote, the court said a prospective juror must be able to give the accused a fair and impartial trial. And I would suggest a fair trial is not just that they don't come with any bias towards either side, it's that they will be able to participate and be one of those 12 people who can decide whether this person was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and participate in deliberations. And the court said if there be this court quoted Breeden, and the court said if there be a reasonable doubt whether the juror possesses these qualifications, that doubt is sufficient to ensure his exclusion. For it's not only important that justice should be impartially administered, but it should also flow through channels as free from suspicion as possible. So, in closing, when we got a juror that says, I've got other things on my mind, I can't do it. I'll have a difficult time do it. That person's impaired, and we should get another prospective juror on the panel. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll greet counsel and then take up.